Hosting for this podcast is made possible through mtgcast.com, which is supported by a generous contribution from quietspeculation.com, Magic's premier trading and financial news site.
Welcome to another episode of Don't Poke the Bears. I am your host, Brian, the Writing Bear. Joining me on the line, instead of Randall, because Randall's stuck in traffic, I have our extra super secret special guest, Level 3 Judge John Carter, Benjamin Franklin's personal teddy bear. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Brian? Thanks for having me on.
Well, John, I kind of wanted to have you on, mostly because you've been to an infinitely larger number of pre-releases than I have. And you would have more insight as to what kind of things to look out for at a pre-release, what kind of things that or mistakes people are likely to make at a pre-release with newer mechanics. And so I just kind of wanted to have you on because I'm only a level one judge. You know this because you're the one who certified me.
We all make mistakes in life, don't we?
Yes, we do. Hey, wait a minute. So, John, is there anything that you wanted to start off with before I started asking you questions or...
Well, in general, when we're looking at Theros as a set, I'd like to remind people that there are a bunch of cards that are going to be using counters. So the biggest thing for really any tournament, but especially for pre-releases, come prepared. You know, bring your boxes to hold your cards, bring sleeves. But for this set in particular, you definitely want to have a handful of dice around or other objects to use as counters.
Fair enough. Yeah, there are quite a bit of, especially with heroic, a lot of heroic, really good heroic cards tend to put plus one counters on things. Would you say dice would also be an acceptable marker for like creatures that have become monstrous, or is that would that get too confusing? Because the monstrosity mechanic puts plus one counters on things while also making them monstrous, like a difference.
Really, the thing that works best is whatever it is the players are used to. So if you normally are putting counters on stuff and using dice to just turn the die to whatever the appropriate number is, as long as you can remember whether or not monstrous things are monstrous, then that's really best. We find that if you ask people, oh, do it this special way because it's slightly different, they try and do that and wind up messing it up because they just haven't figured out how they really want to handle that. One option is, for example, using dice to represent a number of plus one counters and using a colored bead or something like that to represent the status of being monstrous.
Right. Okay, so that's definitely something that people need to look out for, mostly because what a lot of people do when they don't have dice is they just take cards from their sideboard and just put like use a number of cards under their creature to mark counters, which confuses me personally, but I guess if it works, it works. But dice are definitely an important thing to have.
Yeah, if you forgot dice or you're in an event and you realize you need a large number of counters, what you can often do is grab a piece of scratch paper and literally just write, you know, tear off a little portion of the paper and write out a number and say, okay, this little scrap of paper is, you know, 2 plus 1 plus 1 counters, or maybe use tick marks on the paper if it's something that's putting counters on regularly. And that also solves the problem of, are these plus one counters from a monstrous effect or not? You could, you know, write 10M in case you're confused as to how your 10-10 defender suddenly got 10 more counters on it.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be coming up too much, mostly because there's only one creature that has the whole 10-10 defender.
Yeah, and if you've got a 20-20 defender because it's got 10 plus 1 plus 1 counters on it, and you don't remember what happened, you probably should take a break from playing Magic that round and perhaps get some food in your system.
Indeed. I guess I'll just go ahead and go through each mechanic then, now that we've just kind of, like, people who are listening to the show probably already kind of know what the mechanics are, but I'll just kind of go through them, and then we can kind of go over possible things, issues that will come up, especially at a pre-release, where it's really more about the newer players coming in to play, kind of casually. It's not necessarily casual, but it's not a competitive event. So we can go ahead, talk about Bestow first. It's a new mechanic every enchantment creature has it. So I'll go ahead and every enchantment creature that isn't a god has it. So I'll go ahead and start with, like, take a random one. Leaf Crown Dryad. It's one and a green for a 2/2, but it has Bestow for a 3 and a green. If you cast this card for its Bestow cost, it's an aura spell with enchant creature. It becomes a creature again if it's not attached to a creature. So for things like this, what people are used to is with their auras, you cast an aura, the creature dies, the creature it's targeting dies, or maybe the creature that's already enchanting dies. What normally happens is the aura goes to the graveyard. What kind of thing, like, do you think there's going to be an issue with newer players playing against more experienced players where the experienced player is used to the idea of, no, I countered that because there are no legal targets for it now?
Yeah, this one in particular is going to be tough for both new players and for older players. For older players, that exact effect where if an aura's target is gone, then the aura is put into the graveyard as part of being countered. That's the first time in the world of Magic where we've sort of really broken that rule. That's specifically what the Bestow mechanic is really. That's the big hook of the mechanic. Is that you're playing this aura that's more than just an aura. So older players are going to take a little getting used to that. Generally though, they'll probably have heard about it because it is sort of the big, thing for this set. There are a bunch of smaller things, but nothing stands out quite so much as Bestow. For newer players, it's just going to be what they've known for, you know, most of the time that they've been playing. So the thing with that is going to come in when you're dealing with those players who maybe their first event was the pre-release, and then they go to Friday Night Magic and play some standard and try to put Mark of the Vampire on their creature that you shock in response, and they get all confused and whatnot. So for the pre-release, though, any store or any event that's got someone who's in charge, I'd really recommend that they put effort into walking people through how Bestow works. Now, a key element there is, besides the fact that if the targeted creature is removed in some way or another, there's also the effect of if the aura would become unattached from the creature. It becomes the creature version of itself.
Right.
So that is, it's not just the aura spell becomes a creature if the target's gone. It's if the enchanted creature dies, generally speaking, or is bounced or gets protection from, the aura stops being an aura and starts being an enchantment.
It's an enchantment creature.
Being an enchantment.
Now, the question that I have, and it's kind of a fringe sort of question. So you've got a creature that is bestowed with another enchantment creature, or in that case, it's just an aura until it becomes a creature. Now, if my opponent is casting a removal spell on my, not a creature move, but like we'll take the naturalize of the set Artisan Zara, which is 3 and a green to destroy target artifact or enchantment, scry 2. If they target my aura, and I somehow bounce my creature back to my hand, the aura, even though it becomes a creature, it doesn't become a new object. Is that correct?
Okay. That is correct. It is still a, you know, target artifact or enchantment, in this case, enchantment. It doesn't, the wording of the spell is not specifying that it's an aura enchantment. So it doesn't care that it used to be an aura, but now is just a creature enchantment or a creature enchantment.
Right.
Object.
Basically it was just, it's not the issue of like back in Avis and Restored, you had Cloud Shift where you flicker your creature and it becomes, as far as the game is concerned, a new object on the field, even though it's the same thing.
This is much more like land that becomes animated. You know, it's still that object. It just now happens to also be a creature.
Okay. So Bestow is one of the new mechanics. We can go ahead and talk about Monstrosity. We mentioned that a little bit earlier. I'm going to go ahead and look at another. Let's find a creature that people are more likely to see. How about Stone Shock Giant? So Stone Shock Giant is 3 red for a 5/4. It has Monstrosity 3 for 6 red, and Monstrosity reads, if this creature isn't monstrous, put 3+1/+1 counters on it, and it becomes monstrous, and then it's a triggered ability. When it becomes monstrous, creatures without flying, your opponent's control can't block this turn. So Monstrosity is something you can activate at instant speed, right? Okay.
Yes. None of the monstrous abilities have a caveat on them saying play this ability only when you can play a sorcery.
And there is the caveat in the ability itself that it has to be not monstrous before you activate the ability.
All of the monstrous guys have a wording that says, if this creature isn't monstrous, then do a thing for the monstrosity effect. Now, that doesn't mean you can't activate the ability if for some reason you feel the desire to use up a bunch of mana, but without mana burn in the world, it doesn't really matter. If you were to, say, activate a monstrosity ability twice, the second activation, the one that's on top of the stack, would resolve, do whatever it's going to do, and then when the second one tries to resolve, it would see that the creature is already monstrous and then do nothing, which means no counters. And because it's not becoming monstrous, it would cause a second trigger.
So that's pretty simple. It's just it being monstrous is just a trait that it has now after it becomes monstrous. So, okay.
Yes.
Our third new mechanic is Heroic. Heroic happens anytime you cast a – it specifically says – so let's look at Labyrinth Champion, 3 red for a 2/2. Heroic – whenever you cast a spell that targets Labyrinth Champion deals 2 damage to target creature or player. Now, there are a lot of spells in Theros that say up to two target creatures you control each get blah, 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 blah. If you would target a creature with Heroic with, say, two instances of targeting with one casting of a spell, it still only triggers once, right? Like, there's no shenanigans where you can cast a spell and trigger Heroic twice on one creature. Okay.
That is correct.
I don't think they've set up much of a confusing way with this set to work as far as like those kind of combat tricks. But do you? Because this also counts for like auras and stuff. Like anytime you cast an aura that targets a creature with Heroic, its ability triggers. But do you? What kind of shenanigans do you possibly see happening with people who aren't necessarily familiar with the idea of like a spell versus a because it also doesn't trigger off of a copy of a spell, as I understand it.
That is correct. With Heroic in particular, I think the pre-release is going to go relatively smoothly. But if we expand into Standard as an environment, that's where you get into few spells, for example, Turn and Burn. Not that you would want to turn and burn your own guy, but when you think about it, if you play a fused Turn and Burn, it's still a single spell. So even though it's two parts of a single spell, it doesn't change the fact that it's one spell. And the Heroic triggers off of the casting of spells, not the instances of targeting.
Because that is something that first confused me, because I was thinking, like, with there was a card in Return to Ravnica, Common Bond. It put a +1/+1 counter on target creature and put a +1/+1 counter on target creature. And when we first saw Heroic, I was, there were a lot of people who were kind of thinking, oh, hey, I get two triggers off of this. No, it's just one. Like, there's no shenanigans with, like, the thing that I guess I would have liked to see from Heroic was, like, cast a spell or ability, but, you know, that might have been too broken.
Yeah, that's a balance issue for the R&D guys.
I guess we can move on to Devotion. This, I think, along with Bestow, is going to be a little more confusing, especially for new players, because it's something that you have to keep track of constantly. I just had one. Where is it? Evangel of Heliod is one. It's the white one. 4 white for 1/3. When Evangel of Heliod enters the battlefield, put a number of 1/1 white soldier creature tokens on the battlefield equal to your devotion to white. So, and it says each white mana symbol in the mana cost of permanents you control count towards your devotion to white. So this when this triggers, it checks your devotion. Does it check it only on resolution? So it's like you cast this and then say they kill your Evangel and it happens to be the only white mana, white permanent you controlled. Would that basically counter the ability?
Well, it would have the ability produce nothing in that case. The key element when it comes to the devotion cards, there's realistically two major groups of devotion. There's the gods, which right. care about devotion all the time. And you'll see, you know, as long as your devotion to whatever is less than blah, you know, then whatever the associated god is not going to be a creature. But for the more common cards, the one you're going to see a lot more, a lot of the devotion effects are triggered abilities. So you're only dealing with them at one particular point in time. Like in the case that you brought up, you know, the white creature comes into play. It's got white in its mana cost. If it dies before the trigger resolves, well, you go count the number of W symbols you have in the creatures or permanents, actually, not just creatures, with all the permanents that you have out there, and it turns out you have none. Now, there are two things that are important to think about, though, in regards to this. And that is
okay.
Kara Metra's Acolyte and right, Nykthos Shrine to Nyx both care about devotion, and they are mana abilities. And as mana abilities, they are
right,
not going to be using
be
the stack.
So you can't, like, so, your opponent isn't going to activate their tap their Kara Metra's Acolyte. So Kara Metra's Acolyte reads, tap. Add an amount of green to your mana pool equal to your devotion to green. So you can't, I mean, it's 3 and a green for a 1/4, but it's, you can't tap it and then your opponent can't go, all right, in response, I'm going to kill. No, it's a mana ability. You can't respond to mana abilities because they don't use the stack. Okay. Similar thing with Nykthos. Although Nykthos has a mana cost associated with it, so that's a little confusing to me personally. I'm like, I still get it, but it's still a little confusing. Because it has a mana.
Just think of it as
Cabal Coffers?
As the new.
Or Magus of the Coffers. If
Cabal
you want
Coffers,
to call it,
yes, thank
chaos.
You.
Yeah. So Devotion is kind of our. It's kind of their way of retooling Chroma, because Chroma was a thing back in. Was it Shadowmoor? I wasn't playing back then.
Yep. As long as we're talking about mana abilities, let's go ahead and cover real quick. Xenaghost to Reveler
technically isn't a mana ability, correct?
Yeah, it is an activated ability of a permanent, and it does add mana to your mana pool. So it looks and feels an awful lot like a mana ability until you look at the rules for mana abilities in particular, and the three pieces to a mana ability is it has to be activated ability of a permanent, it has to add mana to your mana pool, and it can't be a loyalty ability. So they actually specifically have cannot be a loyalty ability as a clause in how to figure out whether or not something's a mana ability. So since Xenagos is a loyalty ability, it's going to use the stack. You are going to have to count the number of creatures that the person controls when the ability resolves. So in that case, blowing up creatures in response to the ability can change the result of how much mana is produced.
Asking a question that you might not have prepared for. So is this the first Planeswalker that's actually had a quote-unquote mana-producing ability?
It is the first time there's been a loyalty ability that produces mana, yeah.
Was that...
Actually...
Oh, yes, Koth.
I think Koth.
Right.
Yes.
I was gonna. Because my next question was gonna be. Yeah.
I just made a mountain to attack with that guy and then shoot people. I believe I did at one point remove counters from Koth, causing him to die, so I could play another Koth, so I could make more mana. But that was in a very strange game some time ago.
If this was the case where Xenagos was the first Planeswalker to actually have this kind of ability, if they created that loyalty clause to mana abilities for this Planeswalker. But no, it turns out Koth had it before, so I'm just going to move on from that. So I did have a specific question about, while I'm still on the multicolored page of the card image gallery here, I am looking at Tiferet the Murder King. He is the black and a red for a 2/2. He is a legendary creature zombie warrior. His first ability, not relevant to the question I'm about to ask, but I'm going to go ahead and read it anyway. One in a red, sacrifice another creature. Tiferet the Murder King deals 2 damage to target player. He has one in a black, sacrifice a creature. Return Tiferet from your graveyard to your hand. So the question, like, this is rare, so it's not going to pop up too much at pre-releases, but, you know, when it comes time for him to be played and constructed, you can't actually activate his second ability unless he's in the graveyard. Is that correct?
That is correct. Anytime a card uses language that by definition requires it to be in a particular place, then you can only use that ability when it's in that particular place. So since it says from your graveyard to your hand, it has to be in the graveyard in order to use that ability.
And then, I just remembered another card. So we have Reaper of the Wilds here, two black green for a 4/5. It says whenever another creature dies, scry 1. I'm just gonna. So scry is another ability it's a returning ability, but we'll get to what scry means in a minute. It just says look at the top card of your library. You may put that card on the bottom of your library. So with Reaper of the Wilds, it doesn't actually. Say somebody like wipes the board in some significant way, because there's no actual destroy all creatures in this set, but it does say scry 1 whenever another creature dies. That's not cumulative, right? It's just like if 5 creatures die, you scry 1 5 times, not scry 5.
Correct. It's you can think of it as repeated but not cumulative. Now, what that usually translates into, if you have 5 guys die like that, then you're going to scry, maybe keep that card or not. But at some point, if you're just doing scry 1 and you decide to keep whatever that card is on top, if all the rest of your scrying is just scry 1, please don't be a dick and look at the card 4 more times.
Right.
Just accept that it's still the same card.
3 colors is going to be a lot to ask from any sealed deck at a pre-release, or even from a draft deck. But there is a card, Flamespeaker Adept, that says whenever you scry, it gets +2/+0 until end of turn, and first strike until end of turn. Can you? I'm assuming that people are going to be okay with that particular shortcut. But can you skip the extra scry and just say it like the ability still triggers, or do you have to actually like physically go scry, whatever?
That's where you get into two elements. First of all, the missed trigger rules when it comes to, in this case, you know, increasing the guy's, power. You don't have to really indicate an awareness of the trigger until it's relevant to the game state. because it doesn't cause a physical change in the card. It just causes the numbers to adjust. So you scry a whole bunch and you attack with the guy. Then when you announce how much damage the guy is taking, you do need to be accurate at that point. But realistically speaking, at a pre-release in particular, you're looking at a very casual event. So players are generally assumed to, within reason, be making appropriate plays. So if the guy makes some sort of indication that, you know, okay, if I say, for example, I will scry five times and I decide to keep that top card, then, and don't perform four more useless scries, generally people are going to accept that, yeah, he's the other guy has triggered five times. But if you just say, I'm going to scry, and you don't specify a number, there you've sort of opened yourself up to potentially losing out on the additional triggers because you weren't clear about what you were doing. So for players in general, but especially new players that aren't used to playing in tournaments and stuff, I would recommend to always be as clear as possible about what it is you are attempting to do. You know, generally, if someone uses more words rather than less, they run into fewer problems. Because most of the times when people have feel bad incidents, they screw up a play or whatever, or they don't do something right, it's often because they got ahead of themselves and didn't communicate clearly what they were attempting to do.
So to kind of make a little sorry, I'm stuttering here. Randall just got home, so I can probably add him to all. He has questions, not about things we've already answered, so that's a little bit thankful. Let me just see if I can add him. But while I'm figuring out how to add him to the call, because he's being a little technologically inept, I do have a question about Metamai the Ageless, the legendary Sphinx, also a mythic. Okay, he just came ready, so I'm just going to go ahead and ask this once he's on the call. Let's see. Do loading. All right. Randall, are you there? John, can you hear Randall?
You here?
All right, so...
I can hear you, Randall.
Randall,
can
I hear John? Everybody knows who you are. I was actually just about to ask John a question about Metamai the Ageless in reference to how people would handle him at a pre-release. Again, he's not actually a... he's a mythic, so it's not going to come up that often. But it's a question that I think will come up at some point, especially with newer players who open him and want to play him. So Metamai the Ageless is 4 white blue for a 4/4 flying Sphinx, legendary creature. Whenever Metamai the Ageless deals combat damage to a player, take an extra turn after this one. Metamai the Ageless can't attack during extra turns. So a question that's come up a lot, and I don't know, I mean, granted, it's probably been answered somewhere. But when a round goes to time and it goes to the five turn or five additional turns rule, those are additional turns. Those aren't extra turns. Is that am I understanding that correctly, John?
For the purposes of the wording on this card, you could think of them as additional turns. Metamai is referring to any extra turns granted within the game mechanics.
Okay.
Not within the mechanics of a tournament. So there are two slightly different elements there. People will often use the term extra turns for the five turns at the conclusion of time. Now, do note that if you have Metamai, for example, and you are on the first turn of five, and you attack with them and hit your opponent, so you're on turn number one, Metamai triggers from damaging
okay.
the opponent, you'll also take turn number two. And then, because of Metamai's ability, you won't be able to attack with Metamai again, but then your opponent will take three, and then if you can hit with Metamai again,
so
you'll wind
in
up
general,
taking
that's kind
turn
of just kind
four
of a,
and five.
A trolley move, in essence.
Well, you can't play control without a little bit of troll. That's true.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yes. And kids, if you open up Metamai and your white or blue is at all playable, you should probably think about giant flying dudes that give you extra turns.
So we have... Let's go ahead. I think Scry was the only explicitly returning mechanic we had. Randall, before I get into my next question, did you have any questions? We covered Xenagos, his ability not being a mana ability, and we covered a couple of other cards that are kind of fringe rares. Did you have any specific questions for John, or do you mind if I just keep going? There we go. And feel free to weigh in.
Oh, keep going. I'm just listening.
In whatever capacity you decide to weigh in on. So we have... I'm also looking at Daxos of Miletus. He is a 1/2 for a 2/2 legendary human soldier. Can't be blocked by creatures with power 3 or greater. And he has a triggered ability. Whenever Daxos of Miletus deals combat damage to a player, exile the top card of that player's library. You gain life equal to that card's converted mana cost. Until end of turn, you may cast that card, and you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast it. So it does specifically... So, John, it does specifically say cast, so you can't play lands off of this ability. Okay, so it's not like a Night Vale Spectre.
Correct.
From Gatecrash, where you could play your opponent's lands to play the spells that you exiled from their library. Okay.
Nope. But it does include the rider that for the spells that you exile... You can spend whatever color of mana. If you read through the card, it actually gets a little confusing because there's an awful lot of text there. But remember that until end of turn, you may cast cards and may spend mana as though it were of any color. That only applies to the card
gotcha.
That you remove.
So there's no shenanigans where you get to exile a card and then his ability triggers. And then you get to spend your mana for your spells and whatever.
You're not spending your mana, as though it were any color for your spells. And if there's a card that he's exiled previously from a different turn, then you're not going to get to cast that either.
Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. I mean, basically, you just... For most of these questions, is just read the card.
You read the card, but in the case of Daxos in particular, as I went through the spoiler, read the card, take a break, go have a beverage, come back, continue reading the card, take a little nap, and then finish reading Daxos.
Another card.
Because he takes a
while.
I'm
actually looking forward to playing with this card in Limited in some capacity. It's an artifact. Pyxis of Pandemonium, or Pyxis, however you want to pronounce that. It's basically... Flavorfully, it's Pandora's Box. It says tap, each player exiles the top card of his or her library face down. 7 and tap, sacrifice this artifact. Each player turns face up all cards he or she owns with Pyxis of Pandemonium, then puts all permanent cards among them onto the battlefield. So, if the Pyxis is destroyed before you can activate its second ability... Those cards are face down forever. You don't get to look at them regardless. Is that how exiling face down stuff works?
Yes.
Yeah, nobody gets to look at them. You or your opponent, regardless of whose cards they are. Obviously, when the game is over, you'll want to remember to shuffle that stuff back into your library. Lots of players throw away games needlessly because they set aside things and forget that it's been set aside, but when a ability specifies exiling a card face down, that means that nobody gets to look at it, and if the intent is to have one or the other player look at it, it'll say exile a card, and you can look at them at any time, for example, the blue-black broker from previous sets. But Pyxis does not have that caveat on it, so you're just setting it aside. You have no idea what's in the box, and your opponent has no idea what's in his or her box.
I'm trying to think of other... So Ashiok Nightmare Weaver is our other non-Elspeth Planeswalker, because Elspeth is pretty straightforward. But we have Ashiok Nightmare Weaver, 1/3 for a 3 loyalty Planeswalker. His +2 is exile the top 3 cards of target opponent's library. His -10 exile all cards from all opponents' hands and graveyards. His minus X is put a creature card with converted mana cost X, exiled with Ashiok, Nightmare Weaver, onto the battlefield under your control. That creature is a nightmare in addition to its other types. So that counts for both the first and third ability, right?
Yes, those are what's called linked abilities. So when a card refers to do something with a card, and then later it says, you know, do something in reference to those cards, it does not care in this particular case which version of the exiling you did, whether it was the minus 10 or the plus 2. What it does care about, though, is that it had to be this version of Ashiok. So if you, for example, were to use this Ashiok and then play another Ashiok and try and minus X that one, there's no creature card that it would have removed. It's not, you know, put a creature card from any Ashiok right. ever. It's only that particular Ashiok.
Cards that name themselves do. It's just like, it's not, oh, I have another thing. I can do things with that other thing that has this name, blah, blah, blah. Okay. One more
Correct.
Question specifically that I had. It's about Return from the Underworld. I think I talked about this with you the other night, but just to kind of have it here for the world to know. So Rescue from the Underworld is 4 and a black for an instant. As an additional cost to cast Rescue from the Underworld, sacrifice a creature. Choose target creature card in your graveyard, return that card and the sacrificed card to the battlefield under your control at the beginning of your next upkeep, exile Rescue from the Underworld. So my question is, as far as the returning the sacrificed creature to the battlefield, the first zone it went to, I was reading the release notes on this, and I'm still a little confused. The release notes say, if the sacrificed creature goes somewhere other than your graveyard, perhaps because it's commander, it's your commander, or if it's was exiled as a replacement effect, say by like Whip of Erebos's delayed triggered ability, it still comes back. But if it goes to your graveyard and then is exiled later on before the next upkeep, it's clearly I'm confused about this. But basically, what circumstances would the sacrificed creature not come back into play?
Well, this is actually a sort of an interesting point to cover. Notice that it says return that card and the sacrifice card to the battlefield,
Okay. But
it doesn't say from your graveyard. So it's the effect is not specifying which zone it's attempting to return the card from. So as long as it's a replacement effect that's causing the card to go to some other zone, the game's going to be able to track where the card went to. But if you sacrifice the guy, he goes to your graveyard, and then some other effect exiles it, then what you have is a situation where the card in the game saw it go to the graveyard, and then the effect that exiled it essentially broke the link between the Rescue from the Underworld
and
that
card. I was just a little confused because when I was reading the release notes, it basically said, yeah, if it goes to any other face up or if it goes to any other public zone, you can return it. And that was just kind of confusing to me. So basically the only time that it wouldn't return the creature is if it goes to a non-public zone, such as your hand or your library or face down exile somehow. I don't know how that would work. Or if it's a token.
Yeah, if generally it'll be something like an effect will cause it to be a triggered ability or a activated ability will cause it to be exiled, or it'll go to some strange zone that
gotcha.
Dead things don't normally wind up going to. You know, I think a simple one to give people an idea of, you know, how this might happen if we think about the current standard is if we look at Tamiyo's ultimate, you know, she has the ability that that if you ultimate her, if you have no maximum land size, but then there's a trigger that says whenever a card's put in a graveyard from anywhere, you may return it to your hand. Now, if you do return from the underworld with Tamiyo's ultimate in effect, you wind up having a trigger from Tamiyo, which, because it says may, it's optional. If you choose to return the sacrifice creature to your hand, return from the underworld is going to lose track of the creature because it's not where it expected it to be. If you choose not to apply Tamiyo's trigger ability, then the creature is going to be sitting in the graveyard where Rescue from the Underworld is expecting to find it, and it will successfully return it to
sense.
The battlefield.
John, did you have any more specific cards that you had wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I had a couple items written down. Okay. One thing that's really important for Bestow is when you're playing a card with Bestow and you're playing that alternate cost, don't forget that things that increase or reduce costs will apply to Bestow just as they would to the actual spell. But if you're playing it with Bestow, you're playing an aura spell. So it's an enchantment, it's an aura. You're not playing a creature spell. It doesn't actually decide whether or not it's going to be a creature until it goes to resolve and then checks the legality of the target. At that point, it would stop being an aura spell and become a creature spell that's resolving. So the short version is you cannot scatter a Bestow spell because it's not a creature spell, even though it winds up producing a creature if the permanent is illegal.
But you can negate it though, right, John?
You can negate it because it is not a creature spell.
Great, yeah. Just wanted to clarify. Because I was thinking about that earlier today.
You can also totally avoid fate it.
Oh,
geez. I've been waiting for all those avoid fates in your trade binder.
So that makes sense. There's no weird on the stack state based action where if it doesn't have a legal target anymore, it just becomes a creature on the stack.
Yeah, it can't look into the future, realize that you sacrificed your guy that it was targeting because you totally knew that your opponent was sandbagging essence scatters. And have them own you with essence scatter. No, he's got to have the negate, or he's just not going to hit the thing.
Okay.
Ordeals. Right. We haven't talked about those at all, but there's a cycle of them, and they are auras, not like the bestowed auras, but they each have an ability where when the enchanted creature attacks, it'll put +1 counters on the on the creature, and then sometimes do stuff related to that. And the key on those is the ordeals all wind up having a trigger that if it's got 3 counters on it,
you sacrifice.
That you sacrifice the ordeal, and the ordeal has a trigger when it sacrifices. Now, the things that matter here is the ability that checks to see if it needs to be sacrificed is only when the creature attacks. So if you put an ordeal on a creature that's already got 3 counters on it, it's not going to sacrifice right away. You still have to be able to attack with that creature. And the second part is the ordeals do not actually care why they got sacrificed. So if your opponent, you know, plays a spell that says, you know, each player sacrifices a permanent, or if you have a spell or ability that allows you to sacrifice permanents, you could sacrifice, you know, Ordeal of Erebos, for example, to force someone to discard 2 cards, even if the creature that it came off of didn't have any counters on it at all. Those abilities are not actually tied together. They just work very well together.
I was thinking about this earlier. I just didn't even think to ask the question because it seems obvious to me, but then again, that's the only thing that seems obvious to me. The Centaur Battlemaster, 3 green for a 3/3. Heroic, whenever you cast a spell that targets Centaur Battlemaster, you put 3 +1/+1 counters on it. So that would be, all right, I'm going to cast this ordeal on this guy. It has three counters. Attack, get another counter, trigger, sacrifice, that kind of thing. That's basically the only obvious interaction that I can see where that's relevant, where you're not waiting three turns for the ordeal to kind of do its thing. Okay.
Or if you happen to have a guy that's monstrous, or the ability to make him monstrous, you know, because that's going to dump a bunch of plus one counters on the guy usually. That's why it's important that the ordeals don't actually care where the counters came from.
John, I have a question regarding monstrous. So if I activate the ability and then my creature gets those plus one counters on them, but then for somehow I play like a way to remove those counters, that creature is still monstrous, right?
Yes, the counters are not necessary for the monstrous nature of the creature to exist.
Okay.
For example, if you block a guy that has infect, or a guy with infect blocks you, you know, the minus one counters would cancel out with the plus one counters. You know, that's a potential way to get rid of counters.
Standard legal sort of thing. The card Give and Take from Dragon's Maze, the take half of it, just, I mean, it's not instant speed, but it's still, basically, once a creature becomes monstrous, that is a trait that it has, no matter what happens to its plus one counters, unless it becomes a new object by flickering it or by, yeah, that too, but that's...
Vampire Hex Mage.
Yes. Yeah, amusingly enough, they finally made indestructible into a keyword rather than a sort of status, and then followed that up with producing this new status, monstrous, which, as a side note, not a keyword, so anything that tries to remove abilities, it'll remove the activated ability that says, you know, make a guy monstrous, but it won't remove the fact that it is monstrous if it already is.
That's a little annoying that they did that, because...
Yes, and with Turn and Burn in the world, it actually, there is something that can remove abilities.
Okay, so that's the thing with the ordeals. Randall and or John, John, did you have anything else in your list that I didn't ask about? Okay.
Yeah, I have,
okay.
I have two things that I want to cover real quick. For the newer players, there's a green enchantment called Nylea's Presence. I might be terribly mispronouncing that card. It might be Nylea, but it is a green and one for an aura that's enchant land. And when Nylea's Presence enters the battlefield, draw a card. Enchanted land is every basic land type in addition to its other types. So that means that whatever land it's on is a, you know, plains, island, swamp, mountain, forest. Plus whatever, if it happens to be, you know, you have it on Urza's Tower, for example. You have a very complicated land. what that does for you is it basically allows the land to tap for one of, you know, one mana of any color. It does also allow you to get land walked by anything that has a basic land walk type. What it doesn't do is it doesn't add extra mana. We run into this every time there's some new version of a wild growth that gets printed, and a lot of people, you know, we just had Verdant Haven recently.
Yeah.
That one does produce an additional mana. This one does not. So anytime there's a enchant land that changes something about the mana production of the land, pay extra attention to make sure that you get it right. In this case, you're just changing the colors of mana that it can produce, but you are not adding any extra mana.
Also, like not a card that people would play, hopefully not a card that people would play a lot of, but there's the Peak Eruption, can also now target the land if it wasn't a mountain before. That's largely irrelevant because it's a terrible card in Limited, but...
And for a fun interaction, there is one of the bestow cards
I like
that I'd like to cover, which is Night Howler. So Night Howler is black, black one for a 0/0. Its bestow is black, black two. And for people that haven't looked through the spoiler yet, basically all of the bestow enchantment creatures give to whatever it would be attached to if it's an aura the same thing that it is when it's not an aura. So the 2/2 flyer that's in blue gives the enchanted creature +2/+2 and flying. Well, Night Howler is strange in that he's a 0/0, and what his ability is he gives +X/+X, where X is the number of creature cards in all graveyards. And so if you just play Night Howler himself, you know, he's an XX creature, according to the number of creature cards in all graveyards. Now, if there are no creatures in any graveyards and you play Night Howler on some other creature that you have out on the battlefield, you know, you're not going to get any sort of bonus, out of that. But there exists the potential where if, let's say you put it on, you know, a Mogi's Marauder, for example, which is a 2/2, guy with devotion that's also in the set. And somebody kills Mogi's Marauder. Now, the way that's going to wind up work timing wise is the Marauder goes to the graveyard, which causes the Night Howler to unattach. That makes the Night Howler turn into a creature. And then after putting, the Marauder into, the graveyard and turning Night Howler into a creature, that's when you check your state-based actions. And at that point, because you have one creature in the graveyard, Mogi's Marauder in this case, you now have a 1/1 Night Howler. So in most cases, if Night Howler is on a creature, it's going to be, you know, slightly larger when the creature dies and Night Howler becomes a creature, enchantment
but
creature,
the
not
way
an
that
enchantment
his ability
creature
is worded,
aura.
He's a 0/0 just on his own. He's still a 0/0 in the graveyard, right? The +X/+X only applies when he's on the battlefield. Am I reading? Okay. Because he's not a star like some other creatures that.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
He is not a star.
Randall, do you have any other questions for John? Okay. I think that we can probably wrap this up a little bit. I mean, John, I appreciate you coming on and answering questions and addressing concerns for the pre-release. And thank you, Randall, for coming in for the last 5 minutes to kind of just loiter. Yeah.
I do what I can.
Randall, I love your voice.
All right, guys, well, if you
want to
reach the show,
so
we are don'tpokethebears@gmail.com. If you want to reach me on Twitter, I am thewritingbear or twitter.com/thewritingbear. John, do you have any desire for people to contact you with questions or just yell at you on Twitter?
You know, Brian, I'd really rather they just yell at you. And then you can yell at me, because I love
sense.
The sound of your summer.
And then Randall actually has a Twitter now. After many weeks of denying and gnashing of teeth, he finally decided to get a Twitter. He is @_thegingerbear_ or twitter.com/that. I'm going to go ahead and put it in the show notes to make it a little more easy to read. John, thanks again for coming on. I appreciate you. Appreciate having you. Hopefully, I can convince you to come on for the next one for Born of the Gods, because hopefully we'll have new mechanics then too. But until next time, guys, have fun at the pre-release, and remember, don't poke the bears.